Now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding the courage to reclaim that which has always, and I do mean always, been in you. Very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, and each and every week, as you know, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships, that we have with the person that's looking back at us in the mirror, our relationship with others, and our relationship with God or the divine. And actually, still, a lot of people ask me, you know, why? Why is this integration of the spirituality and mental health placed in the context of relationships? Why not other context? And, you know, my answer is quite simple. Because from where I sit and how I was trained and my experiences and so forth, when you think about it, we often receive, and I mean like humanity in general, receives our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounding in relationships. We are relational people. We are social beings. And yet the irony is that we can discover also our greatest healing, our greatest strength, our most profound peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships just might be within our own families. They could be with our coworkers, and it could be with our friends and so forth. Because whenever we transform, whenever we heal, we also transform others simply by our presence, simply by the grace that has been shown to us, simply by our understanding and how we relate to one another. But first, forgiveness, kindness, compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, we can then be more compassionate with others. And when we are forgiving with ourselves, then we can be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in this profound gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this gratitude opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. So, all in all, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. Or, to put it another way, as Henry Nouwen said, just by paying attention to what's going on around us, we discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds and forgive each other's offenses and share their possessions and foster the spirit of community and celebrate the gifts that they have and live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. And that's a great way to put it. So I tip my hat to Henry Nouwen. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And these broadcasts, I am happy to say, are now podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or if you want to go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And if you would like to call in and be a part of today's show, I invite you to call the toll-free line, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights, your comments, your thoughts on today's subject, the ancient wisdom and spirit of mountains. the ancient wisdom and spirit of mountains. And for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, just welcome. I always like to have new listeners. And I just like to say that I am just a very strong believer that everyone, and I mean everyone, we come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life in terms of our skills and our talents, our giftedness, our strengths, our character traits, personality, and so forth. However, as we go along in life, and maybe just due to some unpleasant experiences or being in the wrong place at the wrong time, we may feel that as a result, we have to hide our talents. We have to hide our giftedness. We push down our skills way, way down within us so that nobody can see it. Or perhaps we were told that we would never amount to anything or whatever other comments or voices we've heard telling us that there's nothing special to us. And that is just simply wrong. That is just not a healthy way to relate to one another. Okay, so at any rate, we do not realize our own giftedness, and we often go through life functioning from a place of woundedness, or we go from, throughout life from a place of being a victim. And feeling that everything that happens to us is, well, because I'm a victim. And we start to attract that, and we start to expect it. And it keeps us in that victimhood mentality. And so we go through life functioning from that place of woundedness instead of a place of healing or a place of wholeness or embracing our uniqueness or our hachayatas. Okay. Well, I have to begin today, and again, welcome to the program. I just hope that everybody is doing okay out there, and if you are struggling in some capacity or another, I pray that you would find grace, rest, and peace for you. Now, writing from the perspective, and I do enjoy writing, so writing and speaking from the perspective of one who just loves to hike mountains, I found that there is a striking parallel between our search for authenticity and how the ancient wisdom of mountains, you know, both literally and figuratively, often give us a glimpse into our desire for the psycho-spiritual transformation. Okay, it is quite ironic because when you think about it, mountains have much to teach us. And that's why I just invite you to be open for this broadcast, just to be in a place of teachability. And you're able to hear many, many things because mountains do have a lot to pass on to us in terms of its wisdom. And every year, every season, from, let's say, rainfall to snowfall, generation to generations, it's our mountains that remain the stable giants, as you will, in our landscape. And since the beginning of time, people have always had a fascination with mountains and often spending their lives or small fortunes climbing the highest mountains in the world. And it is really fascinating when somebody just has this desire just to be able to do this. Some people desire to climb these mountains. Other people just are content to be at the base and look up and like, wow, I get it. I understand it. But maybe due to some physical limitations or otherwise, they're unable to climb. But still, to take in the mountain's majesty and beauty is just breathtaking. Okay. Well, at any rate, people today and on down through history have been led inwardly to withdraw from society and, you know, live in mountains or develop their spiritual abilities or connect with the yearning that led spiritual leaders who often just pulled away from society and sought God on the mountaintop. And it's interesting just going around throughout the world and just the natural terrain that's out there and just the many mountain chains and just the cultures that have developed around them, as well as the teachings and the customs, is just quite fascinating. And I remember ancient China, they record 5 sacred directional mountains that stretch across its country. And these are places in which sages dwelled or emperors made lifelong pilgrimages to seek the blessing of heaven. anything. And so these include the Eastern Mountain, the Northern Great Mountain, the Western Great Mountain, the Southern Great Mountain, and then, of course, the Central Mountain. And these five mountains, or the five peaks, as they're called, are central to the religion of Taoism. And that is living in harmony with the way, or with the path. And the mountains were considered powerful spiritual locations that paralleled the cardinal directions and were believed to be the pillars that separated heaven from earth. And in the research that I did, according to ancient Chinese cosmology, the realm of heaven covered the realm of earth. And from this belief came the idea that heaven could fall down if it wasn't supported. Okay, and thus the different energies of these mountains influenced the spiritual traditions that grew on each of them. And as the mountains themselves were believed to house spiritual energies and actually held up heaven, and so, you know, thousands and millions of people would make pilgrimages to these mountains throughout China in order to receive the blessing of the land and the mountains. Well, another example of a very famous mountain is Kropatrick, and perhaps it's the most important Catholic pilgrimage destination in Ireland, probably next to the Blarney Stone. I don't know. I've never been to the Blarney Stone, but I've been to Kropatrick. And following in the footsteps of St. Patrick, who I believe we have a celebration coming up here in about 12 days, for those of you who are Irish, it is believed that St. Patrick spent about 40 days fasting on this mountain, somewhere around 440, 441 A.D., and this is the same mountain where about a million pilgrims per year climb to the top. And following his fast, it's believed that Patrick rang a bell so loudly that it drove all the evil spirits and snakes out of Ireland. In other words, they heard this bell and they just hightailed it out of there. They just said, "I'm out," and they were gone. And for most people, then the pilgrimage to the top of this sacred mountain is also an act of penance, often remembering, you know, Patrick's devotion by reaching the summit on their knees or even walking barefoot. And I will say that I have climbed Kropatrick, and it was an early Saturday morning as I was wrapping up my trip in India, doing research and other activities. And it was fairly early. I'd say it's probably about 8 o'clock in the morning at that time. And it was really misty. It was semi-cloudy and so forth. And, of course, Kropatrick, if you've ever walked that mountain or climbed that mountain, you know that it is comprised mainly of shale. And when shale gets wet, it gets a little slippery. So I made it about halfway up or so, and I, you know, being, you know, a guy from America, I didn't want to have some, you know, medical issue up there on Kropatrick. So I decided to turn around and come back down, and, you know, I just didn't want me to be helicoptered out at some point. But as I was coming back down the mountain, this older couple who was in much better shape than I was, they were just, you know, trekking along up the mountain like, no big deal, no big deal. And we stopped and we talked for a little bit. I said I was from the States, and they welcomed me to Ireland and so forth. And and on my way down, I was hanging some prayer ties just to make special prayers on Kropatrick. And, you know, the one gentleman, the gentleman, he was looking behind me and he just said, "Wow, look at that." And I turned around, and both he and his wife and myself saw this beautiful rainbow that seemed to have come off the mountain, the other side of the mountain, and down into the water, which I believe is the Atlantic Ocean. But, you know, it's just fascinating just how it showed up all of a sudden, and just a beautiful, beautiful reminder of the ancient wisdom and the energy of Kropatrick. So I highly recommend it that if you happen to be in Ireland, no trip is complete without climbing Crowpatrick. So you may not have heard it here first, but you definitely heard it here. So anyway, that's part of the beauty of just visiting other mountains throughout the world, or perhaps you live near mountain chains and you know what I'm talking about and so forth. Well, continuing on with this wisdom and teaching of mountains in general, Tiwa Native American mystic and ceremonial dancer, artist, and writer Joseph Rael, otherwise known as Beautiful Painted Arrow, he, in his many writings, emphasizes how mountains metaphorically refer to the human heart. He writes, the traditional form of a vision quest was to reach the top of a mountain. He says, going to the top of a mountain or any high place has the quality, symbolically, of going to the heart or the center of vibration, where we search not just for ordinary awareness, but for the highest possibility in conscious awareness. And he summarizes that the mountaintop is in the environment for the highest potential, because the vibration of light there is often of very high quality. And it's on top of a vision quest mountain where heart and mind are bonded together. And I like that. I like that. And so I clearly recommend, highly recommend, that if you've ever done a vision quest on top of a mountain, you know exactly what Beautiful Painted Arrow is talking about. So it appears that from various cultures or religions and languages and so forth, that they recognize a psycho-spiritual connection to at least one of hundreds of mountains throughout the world. In fact, depending if you have a favorite mountain or if you've ever climbed to a mountaintop and looked over a valley or at what you behold in front of you, you know how this has changed you. You know, indeed, the view can be breathtaking, you know, and just looking at the directions around you, you know, above you, below you, to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, you know, one can certainly grasp the proportion of just how small we are in comparison to the vast world. And perhaps it is this realization that we are drawn to mountains because we are stirred to reconnect with them in our hearts and with our hearts. And down throughout history, many battles have been fought on or close to mountains, which is perhaps as a means of reflecting the heart's inner struggle. Well, perhaps we also climb mountains to get away from a disconnected world, shall we say, and conditional relationships in order to reconnect with ourselves and with God. Another author and painter, art educator and therapist, Peter London, he also writes about how external landscapes have a lot to teach us about our internal landscapes. Okay, and he says, each of these great forms that Earth takes, mountains and hills, plains and valleys, meadows and steppes and swamps and marshes and deserts and forests and jungles and savannas and beaches and islands, each of these transmute to geobiographies of our own personal journey across time and circumstance. The finite summit of a mountain's peak, the river's final arrival to the sea, the clearing in the depths of the wood, they all serve as exemplars and as metaphors for often the steep and uncertain, perilous journey that is our life. So we often are drawn to these places because we are on a spiritual journey ourselves, and how often they are there to teach us if we are paying attention, if we can simply be aware, if we can quiet our souls and just really take it in and listen, for there is much, much to be learned. And yet, when we look at mountains, we may not realize that the physical or the psychological or even spiritual interdependence we have with them for our survival and well-being. Okay, and here's what I mean by that. People and wildlife, you know, often depend upon mountains for their agricultural or forest benefits, of course, as well as, you know, for their source of water and nutrients. And we've also come to depend on a mountain's minerals, such as coal or iron ore or shale or methane or copper or clay or gold or clay, silver, nickel, chromium, etc., for our everyday use. Okay. And mountains also provide a safe habitat and conservation for wildlife, as well as they do affect climate conditions, such as blocking much of the wind and moisture on the windward side of them. And last but not least, mountains are also known for their aesthetic beauty and recreational opportunities, as hikers and national park enthusiasts visit them year after year after year. But still, there is a lot of talk these days about reducing our carbon footprints, from eliminating greenhouse gases and industrial emissions and the effects of mining, to, say, the global warming debate and conservation. Yet, what I don't hear included in these debates or conversations is how the damaging effects of our carbon footprints clearly mimic the damaging effects our interpersonal footprints have on one another. See how it comes back to relationships? Okay. What I don't hear in the let's reduce our carbon footprints conversations is the damaging effects our carbon footprints clearly mimic the damaging effects of our interpersonal footprints that we have on one another. Okay, because sadly, today it's often considered the norm, or if not the expectation, that people will simply walk all over one another. I mean, people are going to lie, they're going to cheat, they're going to steal, and then they expect that these actions will have no psychological or spiritual consequences. I mean, if we assume this, you know, we are just simply gravely mistaken. And as evidenced from our attitudes and actions, we have not learned from previous generations' discoveries and mistakes. And we clearly do not have that ancient wisdom that comes from recognizing these lessons of respect or dignity and value and gratitude passed on to us in the creative order of things. Or let's put it another way. You know, it has to be, you know, or should be, glaringly obvious that the way we treat our environmental resources and animals is in a direct reflection of our attitudes and behaviors towards each other. In fact, despite all our searching for the psycho-spiritual wholeness, we simply do not possess such wisdom yet, because we simply don't understand how we are spiritually and emotionally fragmented. However, it's from this understanding that we recognize the opportunity that is before us to heal this relationship to ourselves, others, and the land. Now, for those who seek a heightened psycho-spiritual awareness, mountains also have a lot to teach us about interpersonal with God and with others, and intrapersonal with ourselves relationships. You know, and then as I just had just mentioned, you know, standing at the base, mountains remind us just how small we are in comparison. And, you know, as we hike or as we climb, you know, we're struck by the beauty and splendor of life that surrounds us. And this was something that it was a kind of a hard lesson for me to learn the first couple of times I climbed Bear Butte out there in South Dakota, out there in Sturgis, South Dakota. And Bear Butte is just probably one of my favorite places to visit, just because the mountain itself is considered so sacred, and just the number of people who have climbed that, and just its role in how people gathered on or around the mountain in order to seek and cry out to God. Okay. And, when before I knew what actually I was doing, I, was of the mindset like, okay, I have to hurry up and get to the top of Bear Butte as fast as possible. And, I missed everything that was going on around me. You know, in fact, I passed people who were coming down from the mountaintop, and, I just asked, how much longer? And they said, well, okay, it's this, you have to go around and climb up there, but you're not too far. You got about another half hour or so of climbing to go. But don't worry, when you get to the top, it is worth it. The view is spectacular. It is really a spiritual moment up there. And so that really kind of spurred me on. It's like, all right, cool, let's get to the top. So when I got to the top, I saw beautiful prayer ties, and I offered my own prayers and prayer ties as well for people who I said I would carry prayers for. And as I was coming down from the mountain, of course, I met people who were coming up the mountain, and of course, they asked me, well, how much further to the top? And that's when I said, well, don't worry about it, because you're about halfway, or you're about, three quarters of the way. You just go around, you're just going to make a turn and go around the mountain. It's going to seem, but don't worry. When you get to the top, it's worth it. The view is spectacular. And we wished each other well, and I continued down the mountain, and that's when it hit me. I was so worried about just getting to the top that I missed the beauty and splendor and the lessons along the way. So I simply slowed down, took my time, and paid attention to what I was seeing and hearing and feeling. Okay. Well, in these moments, when we have a greater awakening of how our uniqueness has been gifted by God, as well as our growing edges and vulnerable areas, and these places where we have yet to surrender to God, in a sense, we can be overcome with a sense of gratitude and understanding. Even though we may not know what we might discover about ourselves, people continue to seek God with the help of mountains. And moreover, whatever we experience can be a powerful psycho-spiritual transformation that leaves us unlike we were before. And I can attest to that. Every mountain I've climbed, when I reached the top and offered prayers or just simply gratitude for my life and everything that God has brought me to and through, and coming down from the mountain, I was not the same person when I first started. Something had changed in me. Something had shifted. So I just no longer looked at myself or others or the world with the same perspective that I had before climbing that mountain. Okay? And yet herein lies the irony of humanity. That history has demonstrated how some people are only drawn to mountains to extract the minerals, but are not drawn to people. In other words, people often will sell their souls for all the natural resources that they can procure, while at the same time throwing away the most important resource of all, namely relationships. Relationships that have been established by a loving Creator's hand. And it's this psycho-spiritual disconnection that is something the land does not forget. Indeed, the land remembers. Souls and souls have trekked the lands for countless generations. When we think about it, the air that they breathe is the same air we breathe. And the same sources of water from which they drank, we drink. And the same mountains they have climbed for psycho-spiritual renewal, we climb today. These literal and spiritual paths have been blazed for us to follow, and our imprint doesn't go unnoticed. And as we walk in the footsteps of, let's say, our ancestors and our relations, and as a great cloud of witnesses, they carefully observe our attitudes and our actions. Yeah, the land remembers. Mountains remember. through the countless violence and aggressions that have been displayed throughout history, in which, let's say, the human stain has been communicated. Even the blood of those who laid slain cry out from the land, which is imprinted with the horrors of, let's say, genocide or desolation. And we may attempt to forget about these tragedies, you know, as the so-called history books are written from a softer perspective that, let's say, romanticizes the harsh reminders of the depraved human interaction. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on this subject. So if you know, you've been sitting and listening to me and you have a couple of questions or like to make a comment or so, invite you to call in after the break. That number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck. And I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, before we go further in the show, I just want to say a word about next week's broadcast. It's entitled, We Sat Down by the River and Wept. We sat down by the river and wept. And interesting, the power of reflection or surrender and forgiveness and sowing the seeds of growth. Or to, let's say, another way, as Paulo Coelho says, the energy of hate will take you nowhere. But the energy of forgiveness, which is manifested through love, will manage to change your life in a positive sense. So that is next Friday, March 12th. We sat down by the river and wept. Well, earlier in the show, we have been talking about the spirit of mountains. And mountains often fascinate people by their beauty and their majesty. In fact, for those who seek a heightened psycho-spiritual awareness, mountains have a lot to teach us about, as I said, the interpersonal, God and others, and the intrapersonal with ourselves, these relationships. And we clearly do not possess this ancient wisdom yet that comes from recognizing those lessons of respect and dignity and value and gratitude passed on to us through the creative order of things, to put it that way. Or, you know, to put it another way, it should be so obvious to us that the way we treat our environmental resources and animals is definitely a direct reflection of our attitudes and behaviors towards one another. In fact, all of our, despite all our searching for, let's say, a psycho-spiritual wholeness or a psycho-spiritual integration, we simply just struggle to possess, you know, such wisdom. Because we don't understand how we are spiritually and emotionally fragmented. Yet it's from this understanding that we recognize the opportunity that is before us to heal the relationship to ourselves, to heal the relationship to others, and certainly to heal our relationship that we have with the land. And it is through this that the land remembers, as I mentioned before the break, and through the countless violence and aggression throughout history in which the stain is communicated time and time again. And as I mentioned, even the blood of those who laid slain cry out from the land, which is imprinted with the horrors of, let's say, genocide or desolation. And we may want to forget about these tragedies, but the land does not forget. You know, we may want to shield ourselves from the reminder of, if we're standing on a certain place or a ground or a mountain, what kind of atrocities were being done there, and what kind of imprint has been put on the land. Okay, they are certainly harsh reminders. And however, the echoes of pain and suffering tell us that these stories need to be heard and shared. Okay. Let me read to you a quote that I came across the other week about this very thing, about the imprint and how the land remembers everything that has been done on it, or in it, or underneath. It says, "I listened to the screams of the wounded and dying carried on the wind across the prairie. Blood spilled in the ground. We tend to forget about these things, but the trees, they remember. The rocks, they remember. The earth, it remembers. They remember when we forget. Their story is forever imprinted, imprinted on this land. And if we listen, they will guide us. They will give us visions. They will tell us stories. Past, present, and future all touch one another because time does not exist. For spirits, time does not exist. Can you hear them? Can you hear their cries?" Well, by inviting us to understand how mountains teach us about authenticity, we certainly are called to heal from our psycho-spiritual wounds and to reclaim our connectedness to all living things. We not only discover who we are in relation to all of creation, but we also understand that we are stewards, that we are entrusted with the care of the world that provides for us. I mean, we simply come into this world and what we have is not at our disposal, but it's what's been entrusted to us. And really, what do we do with what has been entrusted to us? How do we care for that? How do we pass that on to others? How do we ensure that the things that we're passing on are going to be life-giving to the next generations, even generations, let's say, perhaps we will never meet, but we are still connected to? And a vital aspect of this connection is then to develop ways to reconnect these fragmented areas of our lives that have been separated by, let's say, the losses that we have encountered in our life, or the pain or the trauma. And after careful introspection of our woundedness, and let's be honest here, you know, this takes a lot of courage. Because it doesn't matter who you are. Nobody really wants to look at their wounds. Nobody wants to consider how they have been impacted or how they have been affected by their wounds. It does take courage to even contemplate, even to ask tough questions about just what happened to us and how do we put the pieces of our lives back together. Okay? And so after careful introspection of our woundedness, we may realize that we have intentionally or unintentionally given away those parts of ourselves as a means of survival. Okay? And this is something that I refer to each week at the beginning of this broadcast. It's just we don't realize this, but it's out of this self-preservation because we don't know what else to do. Or we might feel ridicule, or we might fear humiliation, or we might fear something else of if we show like the very best parts of ourselves, that in some way is going to be exploited. And we push that giftedness, those very, very precious things of who we are, way, way down, and, you know, out of fear. But when we realize that when we're able to heal and when we're able to show that giftedness and uniqueness and the very best things of ourselves and just who we simply are, when we allow those things to come out and when we allow those things to, you know, dominate our lives, tremendous things happen. In fact, the ridicule, the shame, the humiliation, all that are just no match for somebody who is living in their just total, all-encompassing authenticity. It is so life-giving that those negative, energy-filled aspects that come from people who don't quite know what's going on, but yet they are also wounded themselves, those things just simply cannot stand up to that. And that's how powerful being in authentic, genuine relationships is all about. Well, Native American Chippewa activist Sun Bear, again, another one of my favorites, referred to the kind of behavior that whenever we give away parts of ourselves as a means of survival, he often refers to it as people giving away their personal power. And it leaves them with little to no precious emotional energy to live authentically. And today, you know, mental health professionals refer to this giving away of ourselves as dissociation. And dissociation occurs whenever we, let's say, emotionally or physically detach or psychologically detach or separate ourselves in situations or the reality that have become overwhelming or perceived as life-threatening, okay? And examples of dissociation range from simply daydreaming to relieve stress or boredom to, let's say, more severe cases of amnesia, which the brain protects us from further traumatic damage or abuse or conflict. And in severe cases, you know, people are often given a diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder. And this is when a person's situation is so emotionally and or physically or spiritually or psychologically overwhelming that there's a fragmentation or a split of his or her identity and perceived reality. And consequently, an alternative identity or identities emerge to just further shield or protect the wounded, vulnerable self. Okay. There's a famous, I believe it's still in production. We can still probably get it on Hulu or Netflix or Amazon Prime or one of these other places. But if you've ever seen the movie or read the book Sybil, S-Y-B-I-L, this certainly captures in a very graphic manner how this dissociative identity disorder can emerge. And it often is, begins in Sybil's case as just very, very graphic, horrific childhood trauma. I won't give away the story, but you have to watch it sometime. However, I will caution you to watch it with a friend. Do not watch it by yourself, okay? Because you'll want to discuss, or if you just need to process things together. But invite a friend over, or your wife, or husband, or other family members, and just strap in and hang on for the ride because it is a very graphic movie. But that's dissociative identity disorder, or back in the day, it was called multiple personality disorder. Okay. So one of the things I really enjoy, getting back to our theme of mountains, is, when I find people, who've climbed mountains and really are able to capture just the wonderful wisdom and the energy of the mountains, they often describe it similar to different parts of a symphony. And here's what I mean. There's a point to a symphony where the music begins softly, and then it starts to swell and swell and swell to a heart beating crescendo. I mean, we feel that inside, you know, just as the timpanis are going, the drums and the horns are carrying us along. And we find ourselves at the very height of its music when the sounds of, say, the cymbals crash and the drums thunder a vibration in our hearts and clearly into our throats. And we feel our spirits lifted, almost as if we've been taken to a higher, better place outside of ourselves. And magically transformed, it's within this atmosphere of sound where we want to stay because the feelings are so euphoric. We love it. And perhaps it's within this moment of sound we're able to transcend something in ourselves that we have been unable to do by any other means. And yet, just as quickly as there is this crescendo, there is also this descent that brings our feet back down to earth, back down to the everyday sounds of traffic, conversations, and machines. But still, we tell ourselves that, wow, that was wonderful. That we feel like we've been on a great journey, which we want to retain that memory for as long as possible. And we might even find ourselves that the music carries us as we leave the concert hall or wherever we heard the music, auditorium or theater. And it's in this distant memory of the music that we often try to get back to. And so we buy CDs and we download the music or something to remind us of that great experience. And just as we have to leave the concert hall or the auditorium or theater, whatever, we too, for those who have climbed the mountains, we too have to come down from that mountain and live out in relationships what we have encountered at the mountaintop. And if we have not invested time or authenticity in these relationships, we may find ourselves as emotionally empty or, let's say, spiritually emaciated, as the land itself has been stripped of its resources down throughout history. And sooner or later, we have to return to, like, say, our daily routines and discover new ways to live our psycho-spiritual transformative experiences. And inasmuch as we may have experienced an exhilarating psycho-spiritual transformation, the irony is that these life-changing moments are not necessarily for ourselves. Okay? Indeed, just as strong as the experience of this psycho-spiritual transformation was or is, we are then called to transcend these mountaintop experiences by getting beyond our self-serving attitudes or our codependent behaviors and embrace our mutually shared connection to one another. In other words, shifting our focus from what do we get out of this to how do we keep it? And how are we gifted then to serve others? How can we live, you know, authentically, that is life-giving, to the emotional, physical, or even spiritual well-being of others and ourselves? And what about where does this transformation first take place in us? Is it emotionally? Is it physically? Is it psychologically? Is it spiritually? Yeah, all the above. But where does this transformation first take place in us? Well, it depends. It depends on where we are in our journey, our path. And for that matter, what exactly is transformed? And are there certain times in our lives when, let's say, we are more ripe for transformation? Or is it a matter of just being in the right place at the right time? And are we simply responding to God's call, stirring our hearts and nudging us along? Well, regardless of the questions, you know, certainly being aware of God's Spirit in our lives always requires a response from us. Let's call it an act of faith, okay? But let's also remember that ignoring God and an indecisiveness to take the initial steps of self-discovery is also a response. You know, yeah, it's true that the psycho-spiritual transformation is initiated often by God, but it's also an intentional daily effort on our behalf. It's not some passive phenomenon. It requires an active participation or work on our part. In other words, we have to come down from the mountain and live it out. We have to live out this transformation, and that could take the rest of our lives. But it's all going to be set in the backdrop and the context of our relationships. Because as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, it's within relationships where we often experience our deepest, most horrific, you know, emotional, psychological, spiritual, or even physical wounds. But yet, ironically, it's also within healthier relationships where we can experience just wonderful transformation and the depth of healing emotionally, psychologically, physically, and spiritually. Transformation places us on a path, if you will, or a journey to follow and embrace all what God has in store for us. And yet, transformation also compels us to transcend ourselves and our surroundings in order to fan the flames of this internal spiritual fire that has been sparked in us. And from the Christian perspective, the psycho-spiritual transformation results in a life of service to others, following the example of how Christ served and healed and redeemed humanity. And as romantic as being on this psycho-spiritual journey sounds, we will be faced with dangerous obstacles that just might block our way from the social context in which we live. In other words, not everybody is going to be, you know, accepting of our spiritual journey and welcome us with open arms. I mean, not everybody we encounter or we attempt to serve or reach out to understands or trusts our motives. I mean, we're social beings, okay? And we have to contend within the context of, you know, relationships, but also those relationships are placed within cultural norms or rituals and expectations. And when these types of reactions occur, you know, let's not take society's response personally or discourage us from what we would like to do with our lives. And the truth is that there's going to be times when our spiritual journey takes us beyond the so-called social convention. It just simply has to. We're never the same. And it's just amazing where it's going to take us. And when we and others recognize this change, we are very fortunate. In fact, people who knew us before our transformation may dismiss us, believing that, yeah, well, it's just a, you know, this new attitude you have, it's just a phase you're going through. It won't last. You'll go back to the same old person you were. We'll just give it time. We will wait and see. And, you know, we just have to take those comments with a grain of salt. And just realize that many people are still living with this skeptical, what's the catch kind of perspective. Or they may simply be waiting for us to get over it and return to the way we used to be. And admittedly, I believe they are in for a long wait. It's just interesting. They don't know what to do at that point. Yet in response, do we ignore the stirrings of our hearts and simply turn our backs on society? Or do we understand that what has been transformed in us actually compels us to re-engage society to heal the suffering of others? Remember, we go up the mountain, we have to come down from the mountain. We have to live out these transformative experiences, these mountaintop experiences. And so we need this kind of transformation in our lives. But yet, it compels us not to seclude ourselves away, but it compels us to come down from the mountain and re-engage society in order to reach out to others, in order to heal others, in order to remind them that they're not alone, to remind them that somebody cares, to remind them that the very best of who they are has yet to come out, to be discovered, to be shared. And undeniably, as I said, once we've been transformed in this manner, we're never going to look at life or others the same as we did before, because we're now looking at the world with our awakened soul and discern every experience through the lens of heaven's perspectives. And as a result, all things in our lives are going to undergo a transformation. Even work becomes a sense of a worshipful experience. And within every person, I strongly believe that with every person's journey to seek God, there's also this call to ongoing authenticity. And this is why I entitle these broadcasts as Reclaiming Authenticity. It's an understanding, it's a recognition, and it's reclaiming the things that are ours from the very beginning. In other words, you know, to come to or come into this world as we are, or no hidden agendas, like we can really hide that one from God. No false pretenses, just simply who we are. And God has always, 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 any culture, any language, anywhere, God has always responded to seekers who worship him with hearts that are truthful and spirits that can find themselves, I should say, at times broken and longing for God's presence. It's this act of worship that and prayer that naturally flows out of the heartfelt spiritual desire to know God and dwell in that holy presence. And it's that desire that compels us to be genuine in our relationship with others. Indeed, it's worship, if you want to call it this, it's worship at its essence. And it's a response of a heart that is earnestly striving and crying out after the heart of God. Worship and prayer flows out of the deep, wrenching hunger and thirst to know God. To know the truth, not only to know God, but to dwell in God, to dwell in God's presence. Indeed, our transformation ultimately encourages us to recognize our capacity for relatedness and relationships. And therefore, a psycho-spiritual transformation is that ongoing process by which God's character saturates a person in his or her thoughts, his and her behaviors and styles of relating with ourselves, others, and God. And such transformation is not limited to either the mind or the spirit, but instead encapsulates both. Well, I'll leave you in this broadcast with a quote from Father Richard Rohr. He's the founding director for the Center of Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he states that a change of heart is always a change of mind. Both faculties must undergo transformation if it is going to take root and bear fruit in our lives. While you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, I am your host, Dr. James Houck. I invite you to visit the website to leave me your comments and to have a conversation with me. And if you'd like to reach out to me, that would be wonderful. I love to hear from people all the time. So again, the website is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. So until next week, I wish everybody well. Please be safe. Please behave yourselves and go in the peace of God. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.